Paige Raidman, A New Understanding of Things Indian, George Raley's Negotiation of the Residential School Experience, BC Studies, No. 110, Summer, 1996. At the 1972 Kakwalitsa Indian Residential School Reunion, an ex-student concluded a glowing tribute to Reverend George Henry Raley, quote, "Above all, he was respected and beloved," end quote. Raley was principal of Kakwalitsa School in Sardis, British Columbia, from 1914 until 1934, and the fondness with which he is remembered is striking. For some students, the sentiment extends to positive memories of the school. One ex-student, who interviewed Kakwalitsa alumni with the intention of writing a history of the school, found many who have felt that Kakwalitsa was one of the finer residential schools for Native children. Recollections such as these contrast with the stark image of residential schools presented in recent literature, and they hint at a greater heterogeneity of residential school experiences than is commonly assumed. An analysis of Raley and Kakwalitsa adds a new dimension to our understanding of residential schools by revealing a flexible system with the potential to encompass a range of attitudes, environments, and experiences. In 1935, Raley issued a plea for a new understanding of things Indian among the Canadian public. During his years at Kakwalitsa, he took advantage of the latitude available to him as principal to implement his interpretation of what this meant and to realize his own vision of education for Native children. Through his various initiatives, he was able to mitigate some of the pernicious elements inherent to the residential school system. Yet Raley's thoughtful program ultimately reinforced rather than challenged that system. His very ability to conceptualize a new understanding of things Indian was constrained by the colonial assumptions of the system he worked within as well as against. By examining Raley and his work at Kakwalitsa, this article seeks to illuminate both the latitude and the limitations of the residential school system. George Henry Raley was born in Yorkshire, England, in 1864 to devout Methodist parents. He was educated at a grammar school before coming to Ontario to farm in 1882. He joined the Methodist ministry in 1884, however, and in 1893 he and his wife moved to British Columbia to serve as missionaries to the Aboriginal population. Raley arrived with a keen interest in Native culture, feeling that, quote, "In order to understand the attitude of the Indian towards Christianity and white civilization, it was necessary to study the ethnological background of the people," end quote. The Raleys worked as missionaries at Kitimat and Port Simpson before Raley was appointed principal of Kakwalitsa Residential School at Sardis in the Fraser Valley in 1914. After his retirement in 1935, Raley and his family moved to Vancouver, where Raley continued to write and lecture prolifically on Native issues until his death in 1958. Raley's philosophy both departed from and converged with prevailing thought. His program at Kakwalitsa created a more comfortable environment for the students, but did not challenge the removal of Native children from their family, community, and culture. He rejected the notion that Native people were inferior to Euro-Canadians, but not the policies of Christianization and civilization. Even his desire to preserve and promote Native art and culture remained grounded in the paternalistic assumptions that Native communities needed white leadership and instruction. This tension between supporting and challenging the dominant paradigm is also embodied in his language. When expressing progressive opinions in speeches and articles, Raley often used terms such as savage, heathen, and weird to describe Native culture. Just as Raleigh's ideas were founded upon contemporary values, so they were expressed through the prevailing linguistic matrix. The kinder, gentler version of residential school that Raleigh may have created cannot legitimate the residential school system. Residential schools were culturally destructive institutions that have had devastating consequences for Native people across Canada. Yet to continually restate this now well-known fact does not deepen our understanding of how the system functioned. By taking the residential school system as a historical given, it is possible to evaluate Raley's attitude towards the care of his students with reference to contemporary debates and developments and without recourse to morally valid, although historically unhelpful, indignation. Analyses of individuals such as Raleigh contribute to our understanding both of the factors that perpetuated the residential school system and of that system's meaning for Native students. This article considers three initiatives through which Raleigh mobilized his philosophy. The first is his approach to child welfare and institutionalization. The second is his curricular innovations. And the third is his plan for a quote-unquote revival and commercialization of Native art. Because these aspects of Raleigh's thought were heavily influenced by debates and movements outside the realm of the Canadian residential school system, this article ranges broadly in order to contextualize his thought appropriately. It should not be surprising that, as principal, Raleigh had the power to shape life at Kakwalitsa. John Barman, Yvonne Hébert, and Don McCaskill have already concluded that early 19th century institutions, quote, possessed distinctive characteristics deriving from the personalities and commitment of their leaders, end quote. Raleigh's example suggests that this conclusion can be extended to early 20th century schools as well. Although the federal government was ultimately responsible for the schools, principals wielded a great deal of control over school life. A.V. Parminter, regional superintendent of Indian schools for British Columbia from 1952 until 1961, notes that prior to the Second World War, quote, the federal government provided scant academic leadership to the far-flung collection of schools for which it was legally and morally responsible. In practice, the curriculum was left to the discretion of the principal or teacher, end quote. This federal indifference was complemented by school staff's denominational loyalty. As the University of Alberta study has concluded, quote, even though paid by Indian Affairs, as clergymen, the principals felt their first allegiance to be their church or order. When they received unwelcome direction from Indian Affairs, they were not above lobbying to the minister in whose department Indian Affairs happened to be placed at the moment, a course of action no properly indoctrinated civil servant would ever pursue, end quote. Indeed, Raleigh was not shy about making special appeals for Kakwalitsa directly to Duncan Campbell Scott, the head of the Department of Indian Affairs, DIA. On several occasions, he requested extra funds to finance private music lessons for a talented student, to pay for children to go home to visit their parents, or to fund the yearly summer camp at Ocean Park in Crescent Beach for students who weren't able to go home for the holidays. That Raleigh may have been breaking protocol by writing directly to Scott may be inferred from the fact that the response often came from one of Scott's underlings. Raleigh took his position as principal of a residential school for Native children seriously and felt a deep sense of responsibility towards the students in his charge. He described himself as standing in loco parentis to the students at Kakwalitsa, and he insisted that, quote, this parental relation is not a mere legal form, it is an actual and concrete responsibility, end quote. In Raleigh, this sense of responsibility included an unusual sensitivity towards Native culture and values. Quote, if we think the Indians of BC had no form of education, we have another guest coming. True, they had no schoolhouses, textbooks, and other appurtenances necessary to education today, but they had that creative urge to grow, to make, to progress, to develop, an intuition without which there can be no education. Indians of both sexes were taught to be clean, truthful, honest, generous, hospitable, and brave. Now a race which inculcates such sound virtues in the minds of their children can hardly be called depraved or debased. End quote. The seriousness with which Raleigh approached his duty as a surrogate parent stands out against the background of abuse and neglect that characterized so many residential schools. Unusual as Raleigh's caring attitude may appear against the Canadian residential school landscape, it was rooted in contemporary concerns about the nature of childhood and child welfare. The 19th century is often called the century that, quote-unquote, discovered the child, because it was a time during which the notions of childhood changed so dramatically. New requirements arose for the proper care of children, who came to be seen as innocent and naturally moral creatures, who are, quote, especially vulnerable to mistreatment and exploitation, end quote. As a result of this redefinition of the child, the nature and the appropriateness of children's institutions came into question. Raleigh's philosophy was part of this topical, newly deployed discourse of childhood. His sense of parental responsibility was typically of what Neil Sutherland has called the 20th century consensus born out of the 19th century childhood debate. Raleigh is notable not for the specific substance of his ideas, but for the way he brought concepts from the broader arena of social reform to bear on native issues. Raleigh seized upon a popular new concept, the cottage or family reform system, in his attempt to counter the quote-unquote unnatural effects of institutionalization on children. He argued for the cottage system as a, quote, forward movement of great importance in our Indian work, end quote. British and American reformers had espoused the cottage system as an alternative to traditional congregate or dormitory models, which were the norm for children's institutions, including residential schools. Labeled, quote-unquote, anti-institutional institutions by reformers, cottage schools were meant to provide inmates with a home-like environment where they would live in small family units under the care of a surrogate mother or father. According to historian Stephen Schlossman, the cottage system, quote, helped generate what might be termed a new liberal consensus on a modified version of the status quo, a new sensible position around which members of the institutional establishment could rally to defeat the radicals and at the same time support change, end quote. This approach was well suited to Raleigh's program, which aimed to alter the nature of the institution while maintaining the system and his position within it. In a 1932 letter to Reverend Beaton, Associate Secretary of the Board of Home Missions, Raleigh offered his definition of the cottage system. Quote, "When I refer to the cottage type, I mean a house where each is a complete unit with its own kitchen and dining room, and where the number of children should not exceed 25 or 30 in one cottage." Raleigh criticized the congregate system for making the institution a sort of catch-all for a homogeneous mass of children, a place where, quote, "children are cared for en masse with little approach to family life, where treatment of the children must necessarily be collective rather than individual," end quote. The cottage system was meant to benefit the younger children in particular, who, Raleigh argued, needed more motherly care and more supervision. Raleigh wrote that no one believes institutional care, however good, is suitable for young children except in unusual cases. In exceptional cases only could we be justified taking young children 6 to 8 years old away from their parents. In such, quote-unquote, exceptional cases, Raleigh believed, the cottage system would help provide the children with the love and attention they needed. Although Raleigh articulated these ideas in the 1930s, he had developed them long before. A paper he wrote around the turn of the century entitled Indian Child Life of British Columbia indicates that he was interested in child welfare well before he came to Coquitlam. Within a few months of his appointment as principal in September 1914, Raleigh began modifying the congregate dormitory structure along more familial lines. By December, two extra dorms had been built, housing 20 students each. Then, in 1919 and again in 1920, Raleigh requested two small cottages, one for small boys and one for small girls. Reverend T. Ferrier, superintendent of Indian education for the Methodist Church, relayed these requests to the DIA on Raleigh's behalf in letters listing the present needs of each of the Methodist residential schools in Canada. In both instances, Coquitlam was the only school for which cottages were requested. In a 1926 letter, Raleigh described the, quote, open-air dorm that has been built for boys as warm and homelike. The boys occupying this building are not over 12 years of age, except the trusty monitor, end quote. These arrangements were his attempt to implement the cottage system ideal. In the same letter, Raleigh made an admission that reveals the importance of the cottage issue for him. The extra dorms had made it possible to admit more students, and he had done so while trying to convince the DIA to provide additional per capita grants. Quote, "We have done the work, fed, clothed, and educated the extra pupils without crowding. We have fulfilled the requirements of the agreement the department has with the church, except the important one, the sanction of the department. Personally, I feel I have a good case if dealt with on its merits and without prejudice. I admit I took these children to care for in faith I was doing right, but without permission being granted," end quote. The DIA was not moved by moral appeals, however. In a subsequent letter, Rowley expressed his disappointment that the department would pay no per capita grant for children who were not sleeping in the main building. Despite this, Rowley appears to have kept the extra dorm full, perhaps through increased subsidies from missionary societies. Two children's cottages are on a 1932 blueprint of the school grounds, although by this time they may have been used to isolate children with tuberculosis, a program that began sometime in the 1930s. Although Rowley was never able to implement a full cottage system at Kakwalitsa, he was successful at infusing the school with a, quote, bit of the home spirit, end quote, and thus at mitigating some of the negative aspects of the congregate system. Architecturally, this compromise took the form of outside cottages for younger students and semi-private rooms for senior ones who were believed to need more privacy. Rowley lessened the institutional atmosphere in many other ways, ranging from festivities on special occasions to rides around the schoolyard in his car. These efforts tempered the harmful disruption of social bonds and created an enjoyable environment for the children. Bonds that formed the basis for lifelong relationships were created among students as well as between students and staff. The 1972 Kakwalitsa reunion, attended by both former staff and students, is perhaps the most effective demonstration of these lasting relationships. While Rowley certainly did not orchestrate each relationship at Kakwalitsa, his role in creating an atmosphere conducive to the formation of strong friendships cannot be dismissed. Enduring relationships, especially between staff and students, would have been less likely to evolve had the negative aspects of the school, such as separation from their families, been the students' overriding experience. The close bonds generated at Kakwalitsa demonstrate the possibility of constructing conditions within residential schools that could neutralize many of their dysfunctional relationships. Besides representing a possible improvement to institutional school life, the cottage ideal also reveals the intellectual limits of contemporary reformist thought. Even if Rowley's well-intentioned efforts to implement the cottage system at Kakwalitsa had succeeded, the fundamental problems engendered by the non-native community usurping the right to educate native children would not have been alleviated. The cottage model itself was value-laden. Although meant to create a more home-like atmosphere, its definition of home was Victorian and middle class. As Schlossman points out, cottage residences in the United States were intentionally made to appear like normal middle-class family dwellings. The cottage ideology was based on the assumption that the nuclear family was the natural and ideal family unit. Rowley never questioned this definition and thus did not consider the very different forms of family among Native people. He revealed his assumptions about the nature of the family when he wrote in 1935 that tribal pride is giving way to family pride. The tribe was formerly the center of the Indian's ambition. Today it is the family. Yet, despite his ethnocentric conception of the family, Rowley often expressed a desire to preserve and promote Native culture. His definition of culture apparently did not recognize family structure as an integral, irrevocable element. Rowley's application of the cottage system and its underlying values still deserves consideration, however, because of the positive experience it created for many students. The long-term negative effects of the residential school system have been overwhelmingly documented, and it is worth considering whether they would have been as devastating had a familial atmosphere, even one defined from a Euro-Canadian perspective, prevailed at more residential schools. The creative initiatives Rowley brought to Kakwalitsa are perhaps most apparent in this curriculum. The program at Kakwalitsa reflected Rowley's belief that the white man, in general, and the residential school system in particular, had a responsibility to provide Native people with useful skills that would allow them to lead independent, dignified lives. As with his ideas on child welfare, Rowley derived his curricular plans from a range of contexts, and his innovation lay in resituating these ideas within the framework of Native residential school education. For Rowley, any program that provided Native children with useful skills needed to encompass, quote, the threefold nature of child development, consisting of moral, intellectual, and physical manual components, end quote. This tripartite division of education was common in provincial public schools, as well as in private schools run by British headmasters, neither of which catered to native children. The similarity to schools modeled on the British tradition is important because Raleigh's grammar school education in England directly linked him to this philosophy. As John Barman has noted, headmasters of British origin commonly copied as much as possible from their own experiences. Raleigh defined the moral category broadly. It included, but was not limited to, religious instruction. In a 1917 letter, Raleigh lamented the lack of a school chapel as being the one weakness of the moral component of education in Coquelicza. In this respect, his perspective was akin to that of British headmasters, for whom school chapels were a priority, and religion was a code word for general moral instruction. Under this model, character building took precedence over theological training. Notions of morality and character were nonetheless inextricably linked to Christianity. Although Raleigh rejected any suggestion that native culture was inherently inferior or immoral, his program required the Christianization of native people. He strove to create responsible Christian citizens of the Dominion, less by having students master specific religious forms and observances than by having them internalize appropriate social forms and identities. Leadership qualities and Victorian gender roles were emphasized among these social moral forms. Girls needed to prepare for true womanhood, and boys for true manliness. Although Raleigh did not question the Christian character of the school, his tendency to define moral training in terms of character building rather than theology meant that the religious presence at Coquelicza was not overwhelming. Religion was not foremost in the memories of the ex-students I spoke with, all of whom remembered other aspects of school life, such as meals, sports, academics, and chores. Helen and Ben recalled a short prayer or hymn period in the morning, as well as regular Sunday services. These recollections are very different from those of the elders I spoke with who attended Roman Catholic residential schools. For Mary, the religious atmosphere at Kamloops Residential School was pervasive, and the activities of kneeling and praying were incessant. Charlie feels that he mostly learned religion after he was forced in 1922 to transfer from Coquelicza to St. Mary's School and Mission because he was Roman Catholic. Raleigh made up for his lack of emphasis on prayer and religion with his attention to academic work. In this respect, he departed from the educational models of British and residential schools, both of which tended to hold intellectual achievement in low regard. The academic component of education at residential schools has earned a notorious reputation. After the turn of the century, the DIA began encouraging schools to emphasize practical instruction instead of academic achievement. Peter Peary, a full-time teacher at Coquelicza from 1925 until 1939, accurately characterizes the DIA's attitude in his autobiography. Quote, "The Indian Department was not inclined to take the children beyond grade 6," end quote. Indeed, across most of Canada, Native students were not permitted to attend provincial public schools or to continue past the primary grades until the late 1940s. As serious as these limitations on Natives were, it should be remembered that in much of the early 20th century British Columbia, particularly in rural areas, high school education was considered more the exception than the rule for all children. In this light, the academic accomplishments at Coquelicza stand out as all the more exceptional. An unusually high number of Coquelicza students went on to Chilliwack High School. Ex-students Ellen and Charlie remember that as early as the beginning of the 1920s, several children rode their bicycles to Chilliwack High School each morning. In 1926, Raleigh proudly reported that 6 students had just passed the high school entrance exams, a number that increased to 13 the following year. Significantly, Coquelicza students continued to do well academically at the high school level. Ben reports that he maintained a solid C-plus average after making the switch to Chilliwack High School in 1940, and the commencement annuals indicate that some students even achieved honors standing. Coquelicza's reputation was so renowned that Charlie's parents sent him to the Methodist school, even though they were Roman Catholic. Raleigh was central to these academic successes. He insisted that practical activities be arranged so as not to interfere with academic work, and noted that Coquelicza students completed the grade a year. even when half of each day was devoted to pre-vocational training. In 1925, when Kakwalitsa became the first residential school in Canada to teach grade 9, Raleigh broke with the otherwise ubiquitous half-day system and provided senior students with a full day of academic instruction. Former Kakwalitsa teacher Peter Peary confirms that Raleigh's emphasis on academic instruction went against the grain of DIA policy. Quote, "We endeavored to get as many of the students in the higher grades to stay in school all day so they could be entered in the high school at Chilliwack. At that time, the DIA was not convinced that academic learning would fit in with village life built around fishing and hunting," end quote. Peary met a principal who followed this DIA line when he visited the United Church Residential School in Munsee, Ontario. Peary mentioned that Kakwalitsa was sending between 12 and 15 boys and girls a year to high school in Chilliwack, and he was taken aback by the principal's response. Quote, "Much to my surprise, the principal was not impressed. If boys can drive a team of horses and run a binder," he remarked, "that is about the extent of education they can expect to absorb as far as we are concerned here," end quote. The attitude expressed by this principal was far too common throughout the residential school system, and it is a cornerstone of the tragic history of Native education in Canada. Predictably, then, the DIA's attitude towards the academic achievements at Kakwalitsa was not supportive. According to Peary, the antagonism Raleigh's academic program generated at upper bureaucratic levels precipitated Kakwalitsa's conversion to a tuberculosis hospital for Native people in 1940. Peary reports that, quote, "The change over from school to hospital was utilized as a lever by those who were not in favor of educating the Indians to the extent that Kakwalitsa was doing. When I first went to work at Kakwalitsa in 1925, Dr. Raleigh told me there was a large lobby in Ottawa endeavoring to get Kakwalitsa closed because we were sending our boys and girls to Chilliwack High School. Dr. Ferrier, the inspector for Indian schools, came to Kakwalitsa about twice a year, and he kept Dr. Raleigh informed of these proceedings, and I was included in many of the briefings," end quote. Peary further implied that this changeover precipitated Raleigh's retirement. Raleigh's grandson confirms that a deal between the United Church and the DIA regarding the school influenced Raleigh's decision to retire. Raleigh believed that the third component of education, physical development, was an essential aspect of character building and a necessary component to academic studies. Recreation and sport, he wrote in 1923, are the birthright of all children. Accordingly, the Kakwalitsa school annuals reported a dizzying array of sports: basketball, baseball, softball, soccer, archery, badminton, and track and field. Membership in such organizations as Boy Scouts, Girl Guides, Brownies, Cubs, Cadets, and Canadian Girls in Training, CGIT, was also offered. These games and organizations were accompanied by a philosophy that was British in origin and heavily laden with Victorian values. Historian J.A. Mangan has pointed out that the games ethic embodied the most basic Victorian Protestant ideals. At the turn of the century, a powerful movement held games to be at the heart of the educational process and believed in their value for the development of ethical behavior and the formation of sound social attitudes. Mangan further notes that this cult of athleticism was replicated to a large extent in the educational institutions of Canada, where the tenets of muscular Christianity became firmly entrenched during the 19th century. Jean Barman makes the same point. It is hard to overstate the importance that was attached to this aspect of character development. The Boy Scout and Girl Guide groups were fitting complements to the game's ethics, since they were designed to diffuse middle-class ideals among a non-middle-class audience. Games, as well as the Baden-Powell variations, were pivotal to the development of the moral qualities mentioned above: leadership, citizenship, womanhood, manliness, and even Christianity, all of which were constructed and defined in distinctly Victorian terms. The Victorian basis of these activities should not obscure the fact that they translated into student enjoyment. They generated school spirit and are remembered with extreme fondness by all the ex-students I interviewed. The boys' soccer team and the inter-residential school Olympiad are vividly recalled for resounding Kakwalitsa victories. Muscular Christianity aside, Games broke what could otherwise have been the relentlessly strict and tedious routine that prevailed at so many other residential schools. The rather contradictory result was that, by ensuring that his students had opportunities to play and have fun, Rowley facilitated one mainstream conservative discourse of his day while hindering another. The techniques of the Victorian Games ethic conflicted with the strict bureaucratic policy of the DIA, which transformed many residential schools into institutional work camps. In this sense, sports and other extracurricular activities at Kakwalitsa resemble the cottage system ideal, which also markedly improved the school environment despite its Victorian foundations. Rowley was satisfied that the intellectual development at Kakwalitsa was excellent and the physical training unequaled in any institute of the province. For him, the weak link in the strong chain was manual training. Manual training courses for girls included housekeeping, hygiene, childcare, laundering, home nursing, cooking, sewing, typing, bookkeeping, and Indian basketry. Boys learned agriculture, carpentry, animal husbandry, shoe repair, mechanics, boat building, and Indian carving. Manual and vocational instruction were also at issue in public schools at this time. While manual training was supposed to provide students with useful skills, in practice it often provided rather limited marketable job skills for youth. Rowley was intent on making manual training more directly relevant and sought to provide concrete occupational skills and opportunities for his students. The two areas of manual training he felt were most important in this respect were boat building and what he referred to as Indian arts and handicrafts. His proposal for a boat building program at Kakwalitsa was bold and extensive. Quote, "I would propose that the industrial school pupil who has been handy with tools in his graduating year, upon the recommendation of the principal, with the endorsement of the Indian agent of the agency concerned, build a boat under the direction and with the assistance of a competent instructor, the material to be provided by the Department of Indian Affairs. The boat, when built, to become the property of the graduating pupil. Such equipment would take away the great complaint that the graduate of the industrial school has to waste a lot of time for lack of suitable equipment and employment when he leaves school." Rowley's further comment that the boat should be of an appropriate model indicates his awareness that the bureaucratic DIA could misuse a well-intentioned idea. Rowley closed his request by reporting that he had spoken with several ex-Kakwalitsa students in Prince Rupert who were very enthusiastic about the prospect of students learning boat building rather than farming. Rowley's position is remarkable. Interest in native opinions, even regarding issues directly affecting their lives, was uncommon in his day. Moreover, Rowley's emphasis on the practical skill of boat building demonstrates an attempt to prevent the all-too-common perversion of the manual training into forced manual labor. Rowley encouraged boat building despite the fact that it would not help with school repairs or food production. Boat building was implemented at Kakwalitsa in 1920, although not in the scale that Rowley had originally envisioned. Boys worked collectively on a single boat, which seems to have been used later as a mission launch. Lack of funding likely forced Rowley to curtail his initial plan. Although he was unable to impress his interpretation of manual training on the DIA, Rowley was able to provide the boys with boat building skills, which were of far greater practical use than were agricultural skills. Important as boat building was to Rowley, he believed that the cornerstone of practical training for native students was traditional arts and handicrafts. This was the issue for which he lobbied most passionately. In the early 1920s, Rowley introduced Aboriginal carving and basket weaving into the Kakwalitsa curriculum. The boys carved and painted totem poles, and the girls learned traditional basket weaving. This, like many of his other initiatives, was opposed by the DIA. In 1934, he received news that the DIA was, quote, "not disposed to make a grant of $600 to continue the teaching of Indian pupils, their native handicrafts, such as weaving, basketry, etc." End quote. Rowley had more success convincing the United Church of the value of promoting Aboriginal arts. In 1934, the residential school principals of the United Church of Canada adopted a resolution modeled on Rowley's articles, urging the church and the DIA to encourage the development of Indian arts. Similarly, the United Church's 1935 report on Indian education included a lengthy section entitled Indian Arts and Handicrafts, which expressed many of Raleigh's exact sentiments and made specific reference to him. In one sense, Raleigh saw the handicraft program as a logical extension of the more general manual training classes. He wrote that technical education already has a definitely organized place in the school system of the Indian Department, and this particular type of instruction, the teaching of Indian handicraft, is not out of harmony with the general function of technical training. At the same time, the basketry and carving classes were part of Raleigh's attempt, as Ellen recalls, to keep native culture in front of us. Aside from the handicraft program, his efforts included serving Aboriginal dishes in the dining room and prominently displaying his collection of Indian baskets, carving, and other pieces of art in the front hall of the school. According to a school annual, Raleigh possessed one of the finest collections of Indian curios in private hands in Canada and was an acknowledged authority in folklore and legends of the Indian people of the North. Raleigh used his collection, which contained almost 700 pieces, to illustrate his periodic lectures to students on different aspects of native art and culture. This large corpus later came to form the nucleus of the Museum of Anthropology collection at the University of British Columbia. Raleigh's attempt to sustain a native cultural presence at Kakwalitsa was the most unique aspect of his curriculum. His efforts in this direction were part of a comprehensive, long-term plan that saw Indian art and industries as the solution to the social and economic problems confronting Native people. He endeavored to correlate Indian handicrafts, art, and industry for the economic benefit of the Native people themselves. As with other aspects of his philosophy, Raleigh's belief in the need to rejuvenate Native culture derived from the contemporary debates surrounding him. Raleigh's interest in Native art and culture dates back to the turn of the century, a time when anthropologists were reconceptualizing the idea of culture. As Robert Birkhoffer Jr. points out, concepts central to modern anthropology, such as relativism, pluralism, and functionalism, were developed prior to the First World War by Franz Boas and his followers. Although the strictly modern notion of culture did not exactly prevail until at least the 1930s. Raleigh and Boas were almost exact contemporaries, their respective births and deaths separated by just 6 years. Raleigh owned several of Boas's works, and he included an acknowledgement to Boas in a monograph he wrote on the totem poles in Stanley Park. In several respects, Raleigh's perspective accorded with Boas's. Like Boas, Raleigh was sympathetic to Native issues and was critical of the influence of modern white society on traditional Aboriginal life. Raleigh also stands out, as does Boas, for his attempt to counter the widespread ethnocentrism, evolutionism, and scientific racism of the early 20th century, when the commonly held opinion that Indians were mentally inferior to non-Indians or were lazy was justified on the basis of heredity. Raleigh publicly argued against this position, emphatically asserting that the gray matter of the Indian brain is not inferior to that of the white man. Raleigh asserted that the disadvantaged position of Native people rose from deficiencies in white cultural understanding, not in Aboriginal intellect. Raleigh recognized, as did Boas, that a particular way of life indigenous to British Columbia was vanishing. But where Boas was resigned to the eventual disappearance of traditional life and presumably of Native people and culture altogether, Raleigh was intent upon a revival. Raleigh believed that with proper white and later Native leadership and initiative, Native communities could sustain their traditions while adapting to the modern world. Raleigh's plans for modernizing the traditional were inspired by contemporary reform movements, particularly strong in the United States, that called for a re-evaluation of Aboriginal cultures. In the United States, the 1920s marked a fundamental shift in the scientific and scholarly understanding of the Indian through acceptance of the concept of culture and the ideal of cultural pluralism. This quote-unquote Indian New Deal was ushered in by the Merriam Report, 1928, and the appointment of John Collier as Commissioner of Indian Affairs, 1933. The Merriam Report's analysis of Native American life included a discussion of education and the boarding school system. It maintained that instead of educators attempting to eradicate all vestiges of Indian culture, they ought to attempt to develop it and build on it rather than crush out all that is Indian. The report's recommendations for a curriculum that reflected cultural variations and the elimination of pre-adolescent children from the boarding school system corresponded with Raleigh's efforts at Coquelitza. The report even prompted several Indian boarding schools to experiment with the cottage system, an idea popular with educators, but discouraged by the U.S. Bureau of Budget. Raleigh felt these American developments signaled the direction Canadian Indian policy should take. In two lengthy articles on the subject of Indian art and industries, Raleigh referred to John Collier and American policy several times. Quote, "In the United States, the government acknowledged the legislative and administrative machine was in need of adjustment, so greatly so that in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a new compact was negotiated, which means almost a complete reversal of policy. This new deal for the Indians appears to me to be a courageous attempt to restore tribal rights and, above all, improve their economic outlook." End quote. Raleigh considered Collier's emphasis on Indian arts and crafts to be particularly relevant. Instead of eradicating traditional cultures and raising them to civilization, Collier called for their regeneration through economic development, political reorganization, and legal protection. In 1935, an Indian Arts and Crafts Board was formed in the United States, something for which Raleigh had been lobbying in Canada. Raleigh was impressed with the attention Collier's Bureau of Indian Affairs paid to practical procedures for organized marketing methods, improvements, and revivals in the handicraft arts themselves, and for the training of the newer generation of Indians in their production. This was the very issue to which Raleigh had devoted his own time and energy. Raleigh's enthusiasm for Collier's ideas was unusual for clergymen. Collier's policies were widely seen as a disruption of the general harmony between the missions and the government, and were considered to be diametrically opposed to what missionaries had sought as goals for the Indians throughout 300 years. As Berghofer explains, quote, "Missionaries and their friends accused the new policy of fostering irreligion, that is, native religion, through granting freedom of worship. In their eyes, such a policy repudiated the century-long aim of Christian philanthropy. Others saw the encouragement of collective tribal economic and governmental organization and activity as communistic, and therefore thoroughly un-American and subversive of United States institutions." End quote. Anthropologists, rather than clergy, usually approved of the policies Collier administered as being consistent with social science knowledge about native societies and cultural pluralism. Raleigh's decision to side with the communistic anthropologists against the missionaries and their friends is intriguing. Equally so is the name, Trotsky, he gave to his dog. Raleigh felt that the commercialization of Aboriginal art and handicrafts could help place the Indian in a position to compete with skilled labor, and thus alleviate some of the socio-economic problems faced by native communities. He argued that these problems resulted from the white man's thoughtless zeal and arrogant overconfidence in that condition we call civilization. Consequently, he believed it was the white man's responsibility to put the Indian upon his feet and give him a fair start in life by restoring him to his previous state of independence. Raleigh was not trying to turn back the clock, and he was aware that the notion of turning a village into a factory for such crafts would be absurd. The stress he placed on academic achievements was one way he encouraged students to consider alternatives to his craft program. His support of the Coquelitza Fellowship, a community center established by ex-students to help Native people adjust to urban life in Vancouver while retaining ties to their culture, was another. Raleigh would have been a more typical missionary had he remained strictly within the framework of Victorian attitudes towards Aboriginal people. As John Webster Grant points out, at the time such curiosity about Indian culture was exceptional, although there was enough of it to add some spice to the missionary effort and to worry efficiency-minded administrators. Raleigh's interest in Native culture and his various programs and proposals were part of an emerging discourse surrounding Native issues. Raleigh himself can be considered a site where traditional Victorian values met nascent cultural ideologies, where Reverend met anthropologist. Raleigh used the latitude available to him as a principal to implement a philosophy of Native education based upon his new understanding of things Indian. Using this room to maneuver, he made Kakwalitsa a better residential school than were many others. Remaining within the parameters of contemporary social convention, he refashioned many Victorian concepts by applying them to a new ideological framework. Raleigh's progressive policies were derived from his privileged position and were effective because of, rather than despite, their Protestant Victorian roots. While Raleigh drew upon long-standing definitions and values, such as family and leadership, he also incorporated aspects of newly emerging discourses surrounding culture, anthropology, and public education, and the institutionalization of children. Raleigh's synthesis of these diverse debates may be his most unique achievement. The aspects of Victorianism that he retained, such as the ideology of family and childhood, were not those usually applied at residential schools. At the same time, he refused to implement Victorian values that were much more common to residential schools, such as the disregard for academic study, which derived from both the games ethic and social Darwinist conclusions about the quote-unquote Indian brain. He applied modern discourses in an equally singular manner. There is little indication that the DIA followed developments in child welfare or cultural relativism, as did Raleigh. In these areas, he looked to social and political arenas that were beyond the scope of Canadian and Indian policy. Debates regarding the public school system and the institutionalization of children were focused on white children, and those regarding anthropology were based primarily in the United States. When Raleigh did implement programs such as manual training that were commonly found in Canadian residential schools, he gave them a unique emphasis. He emulated the policies of Collier and the American Indian New Deal rather than those of Duncan Campbell Scott and the Canadian DIA. The atmosphere at Kakwalitsa resulted from the collaboration of a broad range of social values. Raleigh's selective transposition of a variety of ideas allowed him to circumvent some of the worst aspects of the residential school system. Had he dissented by opting out of the system altogether, he would have been a conscientious objector, but he would not have been at Kakwalitsa to counter the harsh environment that the infrastructure of the residential school system encouraged. The often posited link between the historical oppression of Native peoples, particularly by the residential school system, and modern First Nations political and social organization, raises considerations about the effectiveness of Raleigh's program. Several ex-students believe that, quote, Kakwalitsa has made contributions to the life of our people far out of proportion to the number of pupils who attended the school, end quote. Guy Williams, who became a senator, and Frank Calder, who was MLA in the BC legislature, are two of the more prominent examples of Native leaders and activists who graduated from Kakwalitsa. The elders I interviewed were also accomplished leaders who had been deeply involved with their communities. Citing this potential link between historical impression and contemporary First Nations political and social organization does not justify the residential school system. It does, however, illustrate one possible result of the system's administrative latitude. To the extent that Raleigh's negotiation of the residential school system helps some of his students do likewise, his program can be judged effective. Recognizing that as principle, Raleigh had the authority to shape life at Kakwalitsa has profound implications for the study of all residential schools. His example suggests that there was a principal at every school who had the potential to make a significant impact, either positive or negative, on the experiences of the children in his care. Despite the abusive tendencies of the system, including the DIA's parsimonious attitude, the opportunity existed to prevent schools from degenerating into the prison-like institutions so often described. The residential school system allowed individual institutions a degree of autonomy that created space for someone like Raleigh to build a thoughtful program based on wide-ranging initiatives. Ironically and tragically, the same autonomy also created space for certain individuals to perpetuate horrific abuse. Acknowledging this systematic flexibility makes it more difficult for school operators or staff to beg responsibility by claiming to have been part of an inefficient or immoral system. Acts of violence and abuse become much more focused and individualized. Raleigh's example provides historians with valuable new insights and questions. It forces a re-examination of conceptions about residential schools, teachers, and students that may have been too comfortably entrenched. The individuality of Raleigh's vision for Kakwalitsa hints at new possibilities of diversity behind that deceptively homogenous label, the quote-unquote residential school experience. And it suggests that this experience should be reconceptualized as one that was constantly negotiated at multiple points within a context that was more flexible than previously supposed. Raleigh's attempts to improve the institutional environment at Kakwalitsa are evidence of the considerable, although not unlimited, room to maneuver within the parameters of the social values of the day and of the Canadian residential school system. Still more significantly, Raleigh's actions demonstrate that the way an individual used this latitude made a great difference to the children with whose residential school experience he was entrusted.